It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, Nick, you've led us right into a major championship, starting with the Masters, which is the first that comes chronologically in the year. So let's just talk a little bit about your experience there. 20 starts for Nick Price, 13 cuts made. You had one top five, four top tens, and 11 top 25s, with your best finish being fifth to Nicklaus in 1986, where you had mentioned earlier you'd opened up with a 63.
Yeah, that was third round. I shot 63. I scratched my way around the first two rounds. Augusta is, like I said, one of the most beautiful, beautiful places to play golf. I mean, I always try and tell my friends it's like playing golf in a botanical garden. You know, you just have these flowers which are blooming at the perfect time. The course is manicured to perfection. I mean, it's just, it's such a place to go, and the traditions and everything that they have there. And, you know, it's the only major that goes back to the same venue. So they've done a phenomenal job. An amazing job of just improving the whole experience there for not only the players, but also for the patrons who have been, you know, it's such a treat to go there. The issue that I had at Augusta, which was tough for me, I was generally a low ball striker. I hit the ball a little lower back when I was playing well. There wasn't no rough to speak of. There's a little bit of rough now, but you could basically drive the ball all over the place. It was a second shot golf course, and you know, the greens were so fast and so fiery. You had to have a phenomenal short game, and I always seemed to do best when the greens were under 13. You know, if they were 13 or less, I was fine. When they got over 13 on the stimp meter, I battled. And that, even when I was playing my best, you know, I battled. And it's no coincidence when you look, you know, I won two PGAs, which were both in August, and then the British Open on Lynx course, which the greens are never that fast. So I didn't feel like I was as effective in fast greens, and also the amount of break that they had. It was a tough place. It was frustrating for me. I never putted on green. I think I grew up on greens that were probably around about 8 on the stimp meter. Maybe the fast ones were maybe 10, you know. But those greens, I just, even today, I mean, I'm much better, obviously, now than I was when I first came over here. But if you had a 10-footer with 6-footer break, I was clueless, you know. I mean, and there were a lot of guys who were frustrated with the golf course. You know, you ended up hitting good iron shots, and all these greens, or the greens, they have plateaus and little pockets or elevated areas where the ball, where they put the pin, and the ball would run off, and you'd end up with a 35, 40 footer. And, you know, that's what you get a lot. And you end up hitting the 35 footer, 5 feet, 6 feet, whatever it is. And you end up with a lot of 4, 5, 6 footers, which, you know, they catch up with you. But, I loved playing there, but it was frustrating for me. And, you know, I got shot 63 the one day, and, you know, I was off early. There was no wind. The greens may have been a little softer, but it's probably the best I ever putted in 18 holes in my life.
Well, you mentioned being good buddies with Hal Sutton when we had Hal on and talked about Augusta. He freely admitted, he said, you know, I never went into Augusta with the right mindset, looking back on it.
I think, you know, there were a few of us that were sort of, I think as you progressed and you went further, you know, as you played more and more, it was more, even more frustrating because, you know, it was, you knew what you had to do. And, but, you know, there were guys there who just, I mean, absolutely loved that course. Obviously, you know, Tiger, Jack, there were so many guys who just, that was like nirvana for them going there. And I felt a little bit like that going to TPC at Sawgrass. You know, that was a golf course that I loved. But, you know, you certainly had to hit the ball, hit high iron shots into Augusta to really play well there.
Nick, back in 1986 with that 63 in the third round, I think you came off of 54 holes. I think you were in second by one, if I recall correctly. What do you recall about that Sunday? Because obviously that was a famous win for Jack. That was his last win there. He shoots 65 in the final round. Where were you on the golf course relative to him? And what do you remember about the buzz at Augusta compared to any other year?
Well, Greg Norman and I played, we were paired together and, you know, we were very good friends. And, I think it was probably the greatest Sunday for atmosphere, for buzz, excitement that I've ever been a part of. And I could almost include the win, my winning of any of the, my major wins. But there were so many guys in contention. The atmosphere on the back nine was just, it still makes my hair stand up on my arms because you had Seve, you had obviously Jack coming in, you had Greg making a charge at the end, you had Tom Kite, you had Corey Pavin, you had all these guys, and the roars and the noise was just amazing. And, you know, we were walking, Greg and I were walking off 15T, we were the last group out, we were walking off 15T and 17 green was to the right of us, and Jack was putting. And that was the loudest roar I've ever heard in my life on a golf course. When that putt went in, I mean, you know, on the back of the ticket, they say, you know, please refrain from running and there shall be no whatever. I'm telling you what, there were people running everywhere that day. They were running top 18 fairway. They were running. Jack's made another birdie. I mean, it was so loud. And, you know, it was just, I mean, just a wonderful thing. And I guess a little bit in awe of what was there, but I'd used up all my putts the day before because I actually hit the ball pretty well. And then, you know, Jack posted the number and then Greg, who basically, you know, was playing much the same as I did, we were waiting for something to happen instead of, I guess, making something happen. We got onto 13T and we looked back down the fairway and normally there's this, you know, mass of people just turning the dog leg there. And they were like, 30 people watching us. They're all gone because, and I remember saying to Greg, I said, come on, Greg, we've got to make something happen now, you know? And he did. Back. He did. I mean, he went on a tear there and hit probably one of the best shots I ever saw at the time, the second shot on 17. He slipped with his tee shot and pulled it left by the seventh green and then ran this, I think it was a 3-iron, either a 2 or 3-iron, up to about 8 feet from the hole. Which is just, it was a miraculous, incredible shot. Cause he had the trees and he had to go through this narrow gap and hit it up there 8 feet and then makes the putt for 4. And then right on top of it, hit one of the worst shots I've ever seen him hit on 18 for his second shot. So, it was tough for him, you know, but,
yeah, well, it was a Sunday for the ages. Your mention of Greg's tee shot on 7 or the second shot on 17 reminds me of a story that Charles Coody related to us, which you might have heard. But when he won the Masters in 1971 on his 71st hole, he hit a shot that must have hit something, according to a friend of his who saw it, jumped straight left. He ended up in the right front bunker of 7 green.
Yeah.
So you can appreciate what kind of shot he had into 17.
Right, right.
He describes it as the greatest shot he ever hit. He knocked it about 15 feet right of the green, pitched up and made his par. And he said, that was the difference for me.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the U.S. Open. 20 starts for Nick Price, 15 cuts made. Nick had 3 top fives, 5 top tens, 12 top 25s. Best finishes, a few of them. Let's start with 92, which was the famous one. Bruce was in that deal. Nicholas was in that deal. Bucky Rogers was in that deal. This was the Pebble Beach. I'm sorry. I'm 10 years hence. Yeah. This was
92.
This was the one that Tom Kite won 10 years later in 1992. But you finished fourth. I'll never forget what Gil Morgan did in that tournament. I'm sure you can remember that very, very well.
First guy to get to double digits. That's right. In a U.S. Open. I think he birdied 8. To get to double digits. Well, I wasn't really playing very well that week. And I got, I don't know where I was. I was like 35th or 36th going in the mid-30s going into the last round. And I got through 6 holes. And then the wind started blowing. And so I think I was one under through those six holes, and the wind started howling. And I just put a 71 on the board. I mean, and I went from, you know, the outhouse or to the penthouse almost. I mean, it was, I was sitting there and I had a couple of buddies of mine from Zimbabwe over, and we were sitting there and I'd finished and we were having a couple of beers, you know, and, I was like third page of the leaderboard, then second page and then first page. And so I backed my way into a fourth place. And at one stage, my buddy said, "You better stop drinking. You know, you might have a playoff." And I said, "No, it's an 18-hole playoff tomorrow." I knew, you know, but I didn't think I had much of a chance. But so that was that one. I sort of backed into that fourth. But, you know, great last round. Really, really good round. And it was probably like shooting, you know, 64, 65. Under benign conditions.
Normal conditions, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You tied fourth by five when Lee Jansen won at Olympic in 1998.
That was probably my best open. I just was in such command of my ball striking that, and I putted abysmally. That one and also the one in Bolter's Roll in 93, I think it was, I putted so poorly. And in fact, Mark Rolfing, who walked with me those last two rounds, or maybe the three rounds, because I was up and around the lead the whole time. You know, he still, every time I see him, he says, "I still can't believe you didn't win that US Open at Olympic." So that was one that I definitely let slip through my fingers.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
He didn't do bad at Olympia Fields, although it was, you know, you were eight behind Furyk when he won there in 2003.
You know, Olympia Fields, when we got there on Monday, Tuesday, in the practice rounds we had, it was perfect. They had set the course up absolutely perfect. The rough was thick enough. The fairways were not extremely narrow. There was a lot of run on the ball. It was just almost like playing at Cog Hill again. You know, same conditions, June, July, you know, up in the Chicago area. The ball was running. And then it rained. It rained on Wednesday afternoon and all Wednesday night, and the course got soft. That was the only thing that I needed the run on the ball. I think a lot of us did. But great win for Jim Furyk, and it was a wonderful test of golf that week. If it had stayed firm and fast, it would have probably been one of the best U.S. Open tests I'd ever played in.
And our listeners might recall, but Tom Watson opened up with a fine round, his first round. Of course, that was probably the last U.S. Open with his caddy, Bruce Edwards.
Yeah, another very special week, very sad story.
Well. Yeah, yeah. Let's move on to the Open Championship for Nick Price. He had 27 starts, 20 cuts made, including 3 top fives, 5 top tens, and 9 top 25s. As an international player, was this sort of number one for you
for sure,
as the majors go?
Absolutely. For me, it was, I think, the epitome of golf at its purest level. Golf, we're prone to the climate changes that you have. You can have a sunny day starting out, played 6-7 holes, suddenly it starts raining, the wind's howling, you didn't bring your waterproofs, you know, I mean, it's just such a test, you know, drive the ball down the middle of the fairway, there you are in a divot, you know, there were lots of things that were, there were so many factors that were involved, but most of them were climate, you know, factors. But I just loved the old golf courses. I think that was the thing that, you know, that from that first time that I played St Andrews in 1975, trying to qualify for the British Open, I just absolutely loved playing on those courses. And then, going to, I don't know, just I loved them all. I loved all of those golf courses. And so they didn't need a lot of rough. In fact, a lot of those courses, links courses, if they had no rough and they were dry and fast, they're actually harder then to play because it's so hard to control the ball and get it close to the hole. Yeah. Whereas now we've seen in recent years, that's a lot greener. They pour more water on the golf course. It looks a lot greener. The greens are a little more receptive. But, you know, when I first went over there, and Bruce, you probably remember, there was no irrigation on those courses. Back in 75, when I qualified at St Andrews, I don't think they had – I know they didn't have irrigation on the fairways. They had irrigation on the greens. So they were susceptible to, you know, dry drought conditions. And I remember hitting a 3-wood in the practice round over the 18th green at St Andrews in 1975 when I was 18. And there would be a puff of dust. Every time the ball hit the fairway, you'd see this puff of dust come up. So it's changed a lot. And, I don't think it's a bad thing, but it's just totally different. You know, you could hit a 4-iron 240 yards out downwind, pitch it 180 yards, and it would run 60 yards. You know, you just don't see that as much anymore.
Except the guys today hit 6-iron 240 yards.
Without any wind behind.
Without any wind. That's right.
In the air. Well, before we talk about Turnberry 1994, I think it's important to sort of build our way up there. And one of your best finishes, of course, was in 1982. We visited with Tom Watson recently, and I'm not sure if there was a guy on the planet that felt worse for you than Tom Watson did that year.
Well, I made a huge mistake that year. Having been a good front runner, and every time I sort of poked my nose in front, I never faltered. And I remember that last day on Sunday at Troon, I'd played myself into a wonderful position. I was leading, playing number 9, which I bogeyed. And then Watson had then birdied, I think, 2 out of 3 holes to go 3 ahead. Or 2 ahead, I think it was. And I made the turn going on to 10. I said to my caddy, I had a friend of mine caddying for me, he became a really good caddy in the time, Kevin Woodward. I said, Woody, I said, if we're going to win this, we're going to have to make some birdies. And I birdied 10, 11, and 12. And I suddenly went into the lead. And then when I got onto 12, after I'd made the putt on 12, I looked up and Watson had made, a bogey. And I'd gone into I had a 3-shot lead. And walking up,
it was 6 to play.
Walking up onto 13 tee, and I said to him, you know, very quietly, I said, "That's it. We've got this thing now. We're going to win this thing." And of course, I never said that again after what happened. I then bogeyed. 25 years old. You know, I mean, I was just like full of beans, and I thought, this is it, you know, especially, you know, so pumped up after birding 10, 11, 12. And then I bogeyed 13, which was no big deal, and then 14 I parred, then 15 I got a really, really shitty break. Hooked the tee shot into the left, got a good break, you know, was out in the where the gallery had been walking, so I had a nice tight line coming up the left side of this really tough par 4. And I had about, I think it was 185 to the front edge, maybe a little bit further. But there's a big downslope just before you get to the green, and you could run the ball down the slope onto the green. And there was a pot bunker to the right, which was about 30 yards short. Wasn't really even in play from the angle I was coming from. Just in front of me, about, I don't know, 8, feet, 3 yards. There was a little ridge, which was only 4 or 5 inches high. It was just this little ridge which went off at an angle across, diagonally across my intended line. And I pulled out this 4-iron, and I absolutely flushed it. I mean, I hit this thing right out the middle, and it was solid. And it hit the top of this little ridge, and it careened off at about, I don't know, 30 degrees to the angle where I was hitting, and went in that pot bunker, which was death. And, I mean, I still think had that ball cleared, I obviously hit it so well, it didn't get up. It was driven hard and low off a tight lie. And I often think if that thing had got onto the green, I you know, definitely would have made par, but I probably would have won. Anyway, it gets in this bunker. Now I've got to hack out sideways, chip it on the green, make double. So, you know, that's now I'm on the back foot, as we say in cricket. You know, I'm on the defensive. Par 16, and then 17, hit a pretty solid 2-iron in there, pitched just short of the green and just stopped. I'm still thinking about winning. I know I don't want to go into a playoff with Tom Watson. Anyway, just hit a beautiful chip, just a little hard, nearly goes in, runs by about 3.5, maybe 4 feet. And I watched the ball go past the hole, and it broke a little bit to the right going past the hole. So I knew it was going to break back, you know, from right to left coming back. Hung it out over the right edge. The ball didn't break. So I don't know if it was something, maybe I cut the chip or whatever. But anyway, now I'm one behind. And I'm reeling now. Anyway, bogey the par the last hole and lose by a shot. Great, great lesson. So many great lessons I learned that day. First one was, you know, obviously don't count your chickens before they hatch. And the second one that I learned, which is probably the most important one, was that I now had the ability to win a major championship, which at 25, Bruce will tell you, you don't really know if you ever have the ability to win a major championship. So now I knew that I had the, you know, the golf game. And if I had just played my cards right and done a few things right, I could win an Open championship. So, you know, I took a lot of positives out of that week. But and I honestly think that had I won at that age, I don't know if my career would have been the same. You know, I don't know. You know, there was a lot of money in those days for winning the Open Championship. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that I would have carried on. But the 1988 is the one that hurt the most. That one really stung because I played as well as I could. And Seve just had that. He just made a couple more putts than I did. And that was the end of it. Yeah. But, you know, that's the game.
This was at Lytham. You led by 2, I think, after 54 holes. And that was it. It was all in the greens, huh?
Yeah, I played so well tee to green that week. You know, another one of those weeks where I just felt that I had good, really good control of my golf swing, and you know, my ball flight was good, and it was windy there. Well, Lytham's a really tough golf course because there's more crosswind holes at Lytham than on any of the other links courses we play. I think
a lot of bunkers.
Woo! yeah, a lot of bunkers, and but I think a really good test of golf. And you know, Seve and I were playing with Felder the last round. And after 6 holes, one of us was going to win. We'd left the field behind. And we had a back 9 there from like 7 onwards, where it was just punch and counterpunch. And it was great fun. You know, I mean, I'd always wanted to be involved in something like that, but obviously win. But, you know, I came second, and probably one of the greatest final rounds, I think, in sort of modern Open history that he played. He hit one of the prettiest shots, a little 9-iron on 16 from, I don't know, maybe 125, 130 yards into a little breeze. Just the most perfect shot at the time, and nearly hold it. I mean, he hit it inches from the hole. How it didn't go in, I don't know. But I was standing right next to him, and you expected that from him, you know. But what a great champion he was. And also one of my really good friends. We were basically the same age. born the same year. We've had different paths to winning majors, but that guy, he made the European Tour what it is today. There's no doubt. He did what Arnold Palmer, I think, in the modern game, did for the US Tour, and Jack. But Seve, when we were playing in Europe, there would be 5,000 people on the golf course on Sunday, and 4,995 were watching him. The other five were players' wives. Yeah. They were watching their husbands. You know?
Yeah. Oh, well, he took the Ryder Cup to another level too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Such a competitive guy. I mean, but also he just had that, you know, he had everything, Seve. You know, he had the movie star looks. He had this fantastic smile. He played golf with a panache that, I always said, you know, for most of us, we can shoot 64, you know, probably about 20, 30 different ways. Seve had 1,500 ways of shooting 64. You know, he had three greens in regulation and chip in eight times. Or, you know, yeah. I mean, the guy was amazing. He'd make 12 birdies and bogey four holes, or whatever it was, you know. I mean, the guy, it was so exciting to watch, you know. He was terrifying, not terrifying, but I mean, he was very hard to play match play against because the guy could, he believed he could get the ball up and down out of anything. And, you know, stroke play was a little different because, you know, he didn't want to make double bogeys and that, but, you know, match play, he was brutal to play against.
Yeah. Well, as a Spaniard and a Spanish citizen myself, he was always one of my favorites.
Yeah, and mine too. Just privileged that I got to play as much golf with him as I did. And, you know, he beat me at the World Match Play in I think it was 1989. And he beat me 3-2, and he was 14 under for the day and just played magnificently. Wow. And I said to him, I said, why when you play against me, you play like this, you know, you play like this against me at the British Open and now at the match play. So he got a big kick out of that.
Yeah,
well, all this early Open experience, I guess you're just building up scar tissue and preparing you for, you know, what you were going to do in the early 90s. And then, you know, with the breakthrough, at least at Belle Reve in 92, but also at Turnberry in 94. Let's talk about a little bit about that Turnberry win.
Turnberry was, there were a lot of things that were coming together at that time, but I worked really hard. I always felt like I didn't really want to go and play in Ireland or Scotland or somewhere else the week before, because I felt that I could practice really well under good conditions here, and I knew what was coming. So, you know, practicing a lot of knockdown shots and bump and runs and that around the green. You know, I could do that over here in Florida before I went. But if you went over there to Scotland or Ireland the week before and you had bad weather, you know, you'd blow your swing out. So I never really did that. And I missed not doing it because Payne and a few of the boys, O'Meara and that, used to go over quite a lot. And they always used to say, you know, come with and that. And I said, nah, I'm going to stay here and whatever. But anyway, I got to Turnberry and I really – Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I didn't have very good practice rounds. I was out. You know, I just wasn't hitting the ball like I had. I don't know if it was, I don't know what it was, but somewhere coming over in the, on the plane from the, over the Atlantic, my swing kind of got befuddled. But anyway, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I played really solid. I didn't make many mistakes, kept myself in a position, you know, to have a chance to win on Sunday. And, Sunday, I didn't have a very good warm-up session at all, and I couldn't find the middle of the club, and I knew I was going to scratch it the day around, you know. And I would, if you'd asked me then if I had a chance of winning, I would have said, well, yes, but it's not as strong as, you know, but there was a slight chance. And then, yes, but Parnovic came out of the box, man, you know, he came out of the stalls and just played beautifully. And he was the man that was going, we would have to beat. I mean, he set the pace. He got, I think, three ahead of me through. He'd played 11. I was like on 8 or maybe 7. And I was really, I just really wasn't playing. I was chipping, putting for pars and, you know, running the ball off the slopes of the greens and whatever. And eventually I made a really good par on 10. I hit my second shot over the green out of the rough because I didn't drive it in the fairway. knocked it up there about 15 feet, I think it was, and made the putt for par. And that was a huge, that was the biggest putt I'd made of the day. And it kind of got my tail in the air. And then I birdied 13 and I just started hitting the ball a little better for some reason. I don't know what it was I was working on, but I hit it 15 feet on 12, the par three. In 13, I made birdie. And that was something that turned my day around because now I felt like I had a chance. But I was still like two back, I think, going in there. And then both 13, hang on, I got it wrong. 12 I birdied, I beg your pardon. 13 and 14, I missed both those greens. I hit it over the back on 13, used my 60-degree wedge up there about 4 feet, made that, hit it over the back on 14. And this was all because I wasn't driving the ball in the fairway. I was hitting in the first cut of rough, and I was getting these flyers. Hit it over the back of 15, hit a phenomenal little bump and run up there to about 3 feet, made that, and then hit a good tee shot on 15 and didn't make birdie. And then 16 was the real turning point for me because Squeak and I that day, that week had been hitting 1-9 off 16 and then going in with like a 9-9. The pin was cut front left just over. There's a huge, big false front that goes into the creek, into the burn. And I said, Squeak, we've got to get a 60 on this. And so I just pulled out the driver and smoked it down there. Got up there, had like 89 yards to the flag. Perfect, perfect 60-degree downwind. And, obviously he was aware that if it's short, it's going to come back in the water. There was a little slope to the left of the green. And I aimed for that to back the ball off that to bring it closer to the hole. And I hit it right on the money. Pitched one hop, got up the slope, came back down 14, maybe 12, 14 feet left to right, foot of break, poured it right in the middle. That just made me feel I played the hole as well as I possibly could. And I got close to Ponovic. I now had a par five in hand and, potentially an eagle, but obviously I'm thinking birdie. And if I finish birdie, par, I think I have a chance. Yeah. Good drive down 8, down 17. In between clubs, took the longer one, put the ball in the back of the green, and just read the putt perfectly. Hit the 50 putt.
50-footer, would you say?
Sorry?
50-footer.
They measured it. They said it was 54 feet. So 54. Yeah. I just hit this putt, and there was a spot that I was putting to on the top. There was a ridge. A tier that went down, ran it right over that spot, and now the ball starts breaking. And I mean, I'm starting to walk to the side because this thing's going in. I'm following it in about 3 feet from the hole. It hits the spike mark, and a spike mark knocks it offline, and it dives in the right hand corner of the hole. I mean, it was dead center cut. And if you ever watch the video, you'll see. And the thing hits the spike mark, bobbles, it still goes in the hole. And I tell you what, now I'm running around the green like there's no tomorrow. And I'm high-fiving Squeak. And anyway, I didn't even know. And I look up at the leaderboard, and I see Ponovic's bogeyed 18. So I got a one-shot lead. So I end up, now I've got my heartbeats 250 beats a minute. I've now got to go and play 18, calm down. And I bogeyed 18 the day before. Anyway, I got up there, just hit this 3-iron right down the pipe, went about 260. Downwind, hard fairways, little draw, 7-iron in the middle of the green, 2 putts, and it was all over. I mean, I played the last, I don't know, I played that back nine as well as the way I was hitting the ball, as well as I possibly could. So I think there was just, like you said, Mike, I drew on all the experiences, all the past times that I never gave up, and I guess it wouldn't have been a day to give up, but you would have maybe in times gone by I would have said, well, I'm just going to play safe and make sure I get my top three or top four, because I wasn't playing well. I had to take, but anyway.
And this time, unlike 82, you had both hands on the trophy. So what was the feeling, champion golfer of the year?
Well, having those two close shaves. And then you look at that, the claret jug, and you just look at the names on there. And when you see your name on it, I mean, it brought a tear to my eye. And, You know, I can remember my dad, as I said, had passed when I was really young. You know, I was 10 years old, and you know, I wish he had been there to share that day. That would have been really special. You know, and my family. Anyway, I went down. My brother and my eldest brother and my mom were living in England at the time, so I went down there the next day and spent the day with them and with the trophy. So it was a very special time, you know, for me. And I think, you know, from 82, you know, it took 12 years, you know, but and there was a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of shots hit, and but I was very grateful to win that.
What was the craziest stuff you ever drank out of the claret jug?
Drank a lot of beer and, you know, the black velvet, we call, you know, the champagne and champagne and Guinness milk stout. But the one funniest thing, I used to play with these old guys at Royal Harare who every Friday, and I went back at the end of the year, and, you know, the one that the claret jug is the traveler, the one we get. So I took it with me back to Zimbabwe, and I played with these guys, and they had no idea I had the trophy. And I'd been playing with these old guys for I don't know how many years, probably since I was about 15 or 16. And anyway, I put it in. We used to drink in the locker room after we'd played, and I put the jug in the manager's office in the safe. And then when we'd finished, we ordered first round. We're sitting there, we're about to get in the showers, and, you know, so we're sitting there with our socks and shoes off and whatever. And I quickly ran to the thing and grabbed the thing and then walked into where the guys were sitting. And while they were talking, I put it on the table in front of them.
Oh, boy.
And I'll tell you what, it was like, I said, boys, here, we're going to drink out of this tonight. And it was one of the nicest, greatest, I don't know, joys of my life. These guys had been so supportive of me, you know, through my career and everything. And it was so funny. We drank a lot out of it that day.
Yeah, but just to be able to share it with these guys that were characters from your past had to be a real joy.
I think that's the beauty of any time, you know. That's why team golf and team sports are so great, because when you win, you share with your teammates. It's different in golf a little bit, because, you know, you're basically going to share it with your wife and your caddy, and maybe if there's a friend still around, you know, if you've got a buddy of yours that's still around. Most of them have left and gone to the next tournament. So, but when you have team golf, I mean, there's nothing better than winning. I mean, that's why the Ryder Cup, so guys are so passionate about it, and the President's Cup.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple of other major championships to talk about. We'll forward ahead to the PGA Championship, where Nick had 20 starts, including 16 cuts made. He had 5 top fives, 7 top tens, and 9 top 25s. Of course, best finishes were his wins first in 92 at Belle Reve down St. Louis, and then in 1994, winning at Southern Hills. So let's go to St. Louis.
Well, you know, I got there, and I'd never played that course before. And I just looked at this golf course, and I said, you know, perfect golf course for a good driver of the golf ball. You drove the ball well there. The rough was up. Fairways were pretty generous. Zoysia fairways, which I loved. Everything was there. Big greens. So, you know, you could be, you didn't have to be aggressive with your iron play. There were about four or five really key holes. The tough one, I think, was it's number 6. It's a par 3. It's either 5 or 6. Where you got the water in front of the green, and you have this kidney-shaped green that wraps around the water, and very, very difficult hole. It was 4-iron, 5-iron, but this was a hole that you could potentially make a triple on. So I played it very cautiously the whole week. And in fact, the whole week I just played as strategically and sound as I possibly could without taking any chances. And, you know, I was in a position to win come Sunday. And again, that Sunday, I played so well on the back nine. I made some really good putts. I hit some very, very good golf shots. And I think I shot one under the back nine to win. But it was a tough back nine. And I ended up winning, I think, by 3 or 4 in the end. You know, I got a monkey off my back that day because I'd been so close. And I mean, this was the culmination. Again, I go back to this work that Squeak and I had done together. And, you know, obviously David Ledbetter had been so huge in my life, also, you know, helped by coaching and helped me with my golf. And we'd fine-tune my swing and whatever. And then obviously and then Bob Rotella and my wife as well. You know, my wife had been so supportive of everything. And, you know, you have to have a good partner when you're going through stuff like this, because it's very self-centered, that lifestyle, when you're playing well. And she'd been so supportive of that. And then, you know, that win just, it took so much pressure off me. And I think that's, you know, when you look from that time, which was, you know, August until the end of maybe the middle of 95, that was when I was at my absolute peak. And I, you know, one of the things that I'm most proud of, Bruce, when I look back on this, is that, you know, how hard it is to elongate that stretch. It really is hard. You know, you can have it for 2 or 3 months and then it might go away or whatever. But I grabbed that the way I was playing with both hands, and I didn't want to let go. And that's what was so much fun for me. I mean, it really was. And but that was, to me, that was the real kicker for me, for the, what I would say would be the second half of my career. The first half was the learning curve and whatever. And the, you know, the only sad thing was I was 35. I wish it had happened in 88 when I was 31. You know, then I would have maybe had a little bit longer in there. But hey, listen, I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, you won that tournament by 3 over Nick Faldo, John Cook, Gene Sowers, and Jim Gallagher Jr. Gene Sowers was actually in front by 2, yes. I think. You were 2 back after 3 rounds, but he had a tough Sunday.
Yes, he did. You know, that was just all about strategy that day. You know, not going, if I had a long iron or a medium iron, I just hit it in the middle of the green. You know, would leave myself a 20, 25 foot instead of going at flags and making bogeys early. I got off to a really solid start. And, you know, when you get under the pressure on a Sunday, you want to make every birdie you count. And the way you make the birdies count is not by making stupid mistakes and making bogeys. Yeah. Something that Tiger, let me tell you, was the best at, I think. Tiger used to grind on those 20 footers for par harder than anyone I ever saw. Or, you know, I know Jack was really good, but Tiger hated bogeys.
So Belle Reve, with some great history, they hosted a more recent PGA Championship, but that was the site of the 1965 U.S. Open that Gary Player won in a playoff against Kel Nagel. And Bruce, I believe it was Jack Nicklaus, when we were talking to him, that told us that it took him a while, but he finally convinced Gary Player to go to the major championship venue a few days in advance. Yeah. Mm. Like correct. He was doing.
Correct. Absolutely.
And he finally
correct.
Did that and won. Yeah.
Yeah. Remarkable, isn't it? How little things happen like that, that, oh no, I'm not going to go. And Jack finally talked him into it. And he ends up winning.
Yeah. 2 years later, you go to Southern Hills and, you must have been, I don't know. You tell me, how comfortable were you on the Sunday, and when did you get comfortable after winning by 6 over Corey Pavin?
Well, I took a week off after the Open, which was, what was there, a month in between? I think, hang on, no, there were 2 weeks in between. Anyway, I took a week off afterwards, and because I was drained after that Open, and then went to see Led. And I said, Led, you know, what's going on here? What had happened? And we looked at some footage and whatever and figured a few things out. And then I went to Memphis in between. And I think I missed the playoff by a shot. I ended up finishing 4th there. And I played so well from tee to green. And one of the significant things about Memphis was that I was on the putting green, and Bobby Grace had the fat lady out. And I was hitting some putts with it on Tuesday afternoon. And I just loved the feel of this putter. And I'd been using that Zebra, which Ram made. That was who I had my contract with. But anyway, I won the British Open with that. And I didn't putt very well on Thursday and Friday. And I was, I don't know, 20th back in there. And so I said to Squeak, let's try that putter, you know. And anyway, I just putted so beautifully on Saturday and Sunday, nearly won. And then went back home, putted with that putter for a long, worked on my game a little bit more with lead, got to Bell Reef. And from Monday to Sunday, I had arguably one of the best ball striking weeks of my life. It was like, it was TPS, when I won a TPC in 93, it was that kind of week. And then you couple that with the way I was putting with this putter, and it was bombs away. And it was so much fun, because every time, you know, I'd hit sort of like a weak iron shot, you know, where before I'd be trying to lag up or whatever, I'm standing over this 25, 30 footer trying to make it.
Yeah.
And I made a few of them, you know, and that was just a great week for me. And one of the things I'll never forget was on the 17th hole, I'm walking up there. It's a short par four. I hit an iron off the tee, and I've got a wedge on the green, and it had my name up there, and it had on the leaderboard, it had Corey underneath. Corey Pavin was chasing, and then underneath it had Hogan, Nicholas, you know, Jones. They put all these great names up there with mine, you know, and it was such a wonderful thing for those guys to do. I never forgot that. And then the walk up 18, you know, it was the one time where I've now got so much of a lead that I can actually enjoy the last two holes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was on top of the world, I guess that was it. Cause I did, I went from, you know, second on the world ranking. I couldn't kick Greg Norman off that plinth of his, you know, that he was up there the whole time, for so many weeks. And eventually, you know, it took me two majors to dethrone him, which anyway, he was very happy with it.
Led wire to wire that week with a score of 269, which was a new record at the time. You led by five after two rounds. Your lead was up to seven at one point on Saturday. And you were also the first to win the Open Championship and the PGA in the same year in seven decades. The last person to do that would have been Walter Hagen back in 1924.
Mm. Pretty good stuff. Like I say, it was a very special time for me, and I felt like, you know, everything that I'd worked on, everything that I'd done, all had just come to this peak. And, you know, to win two majors in 8 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever it is, yeah, we were flying back, and I just kept saying to my wife, you know, this has been the most amazing thing. And, you know, she had been with me through the lean time, so she could appreciate it. You know, it wasn't like she married me when I was playing well. I mean, we got married in 87, but 85, you know, she went through all of the trials and tribulations with me. So,
yeah, great stuff.
It was great times.
So, Nick, we really appreciate your time today. You've been quite generous, and while there's plenty more to talk about with your career, including President's Cup and other things, we can always pick that up at another time. But there are a couple of questions that we typically try to ask our guests, and maybe we'll finish up with those. First would be this. If you had one career mulligan, where would you take it?
You know, I want to say that 4-iron at Troon in 1982, but... Yeah. I think, that's a good question. Probably that one. I think I'd have to take on that one. Was significant, you know, time. The other one that, you know, I didn't really go into detail about was, you know, that Lytham in 88, when Seve and I were going head-to-head, he was one shot ahead playing 18. And he came off his tee shot, and there was a pot bunker on the right-hand side, and my caddy and I were convinced that he'd hit it in this pot bunker. And I stood up there. He had made birdie on 16, so he had the honor. And I just rifled this tee shot right down the middle. Got up there, and I'm looking and, you know, seeing if he's in the bunker, and his ball had carried the bunker. Not only did he carry the bunker, but he got into a place where he could advance it. And I'm standing there with a 6-iron, and the pin's right in the middle, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is nirvana. I'm going to hit this thing inside of a foot here. I mean, I was so fired up, and I rushed it. I just rushed it. I was so excited about hitting the shot, and I pulled it. You know, I pulled it 30 feet left of the hole, dead perfect pin high, perfect club, everything. And so that would be another contender. So funny, both British Opens.
Yeah. Okay. And if you knew when you turned professional what you know now, what would you have done differently?
Not a whole lot, I don't think. I probably should have got someone to help me with my swing earlier. I think I was a little stubborn. I don't think it was stubborn. I think, Bruce, you also come in the same sort of area. I know you're before me, but we didn't really put a lot of trust and faith in coaches. You know what? We try to dig it out of golf instructors. We try to dig it out the dirt. And yeah. I think most of us were stubborn enough. We thought, I know I'm doing the right thing. So I probably should have gone to someone or gone to Ledbetter and trusted him a little bit more earlier. I think that would have helped me a lot.
Yeah. Finally, how would you like to be remembered as a golfer?
More than anything else, a human being, someone who, you know, like I say, Byron Nelson was one of my all-time heroes. Jack, the way he conducted himself on the golf course, you know, all that. But I think deep down inside, it's, you know, what did you do to improve the game while you were around? I encouraged a lot of kids to play. I always felt like I tried to set the right example, you know, tried not to swear when the mics were around. Oh, we all swear, you know, but I mean, you try not to swear when the mics are around. You know, try not to throw clubs or have, you know, tantrums on the golf course because the kids see that. Yeah. And, you know, that was something that I think I'm most proud of. And I think if my dad was looking down, all the values that he taught us as kids, I felt like that's what I did through my career. I tried to do not the right thing for myself, but the right thing for the game of golf. And because this game of golf has given both Bruce and I so much. I mean, I never in a million years when I was a teenager did I think that I would have achieved. I mean, I just every now and then I have to pinch myself to, you know, I thank the Lord, you know, for giving me the opportunity, the health and the opportunity to do what I did. It was a great time.
Bruce Devlin, 2003 World Golf Hall of Fame inductee.
Yeah, how about that? And Nick, you know, I know Mike feels the same way as I do. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. And
thanks, Bruce.
We want to thank you so much for all your time and wish you the best of luck going forward.
Well, thanks, you guys. It's been fun, and I hope I didn't babble on too much.
We've really enjoyed it, Nick. We appreciate it. Thanks again for being so generous with your time.
Okay, guys. Take care.
Straight down the middle. Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went straight down the middle, like they say. Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.